As I've reflected on through this book of Hosea, I hope you're finding it helpful. One of the things, my reflections, is just to reflect on how brilliant it is to have a God who makes himself known to us, wants to be known by us, who wants us to feel, you know, at least a glimpse of what it is to be him. He really wants us to understand him. There is a sense, of course, that, you know, God is unknowable in some way. We can't completely comprehend everything about our God. You know, Isaiah 55, as high as the heavens are above the earth, so high are his ways above ours and his thoughts above ours. So there's always going to be a level to which God is not completely comprehensible to us. However, our God is a God who goes out of his way to make himself known to us. He goes out of his way to help us see him and know him and love him and feel him. And I tell you what, the book of Hosea is one of the Old Testament prophetic books where we get imagery that's very, very helpful. God is accommodating to us in this way. He uses so many illustrations and images that are human images and human language that we would understand and know him. You know, right from the beginning of Hosea, God is describing himself to us, saying that he's like a husband to a wife, you know, his people, but his wife's adulterous, but he's the husband that's faithful, and he's long-suffering, and he's patient, and he's forgiving, and he's restoring. That's what he is as our God. He's like a husband who's like that as he relates to his people. And of course, Hosea, as a prophet, gets one of the toughest assignments ever of all the prophets, where he not only needs to speak those words to God's people, but actually live it out himself and take to himself an adulterous wife who he knows is going to break his heart. So he's living out the message to the people. It's so important. Does God want? Is it for God that his people would understand what it's like for him? That he has the prophet live this way. It's amazing. So he's kind of helping his people and helping us understand what he's like. He's like a faithful husband. You get to chapter 11, we get another image tonight. It's a slightly different image, but it's a human image again. And again, it's kind of a wonderful window into the heart of God, where God effectively says this to us. He says, I'm like a man and I'm not like a man. We get both those this morning as we look at chapter 11. Like a man, not like a man. He's like a man in this way. He says, I'm like a father to you and you're like a son to me. Yeah. And as he gives us this image of the kind of father that he is to us, his son, or to Israel, his son, it's not any old dad. It's the best dad you could ever picture. You know, it's the kind of dad that we all wished we did have, but none of us had the perfect dad. God is like one of those dads. He's the super involved dad. He's the massively attentive father. He's the affectionate and adoring father. He's the protective father. And he's the one who's perfectly loving in his discipline and his training of his son. He's everything he ever wanted. He's the perfect father. And in the Old Testament here, the way he speaks is he says, I'm the father, and Israel, my people, you're my son. That's what you are to me. You're just like my son. In fact, he actually says that explicitly earlier than Hosea, like back in Exodus. This is the language God used to speak about Israel, his people. He says, Israel is my firstborn son. That's the way he speaks about Israel. They are my firstborn son. And he uses that language, particularly firstborn son, not to say then I'm going to have all these other sons necessarily, but firstborn meaning you're the one that's going to get all the inheritance, because in the ancient world, the firstborn son got the inheritance. And so Israel, we're going to inherit all the blessings of God. And particularly in their time, it was going to be the land. That was going to be their inheritance. So that's the imagery, and that's the message that we get there. You're my firstborn son, Israel. And you bring that kind of here into Hosea chapter 11, and the imagery continues. God's the father, Israel's the son. Have a look at it there, verse 1. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. So there's God describing his people as a son, as a child. And he says, when you were a child, I loved you. Well, I loved you. So the concept of God taking Israel to himself as a son, it's out of God's love that he does it. And the way he actually has a son in Israel, we get described there, it's out of Egypt, I called my son. Which takes us back to the time when Israel, as a nation, were in slavery in Egypt. And God goes and takes them for himself as a son. And it's really, the imagery we get here is actually of a son being born to God. As God goes into there and in love pours out plague after plague after plague on Egypt, it's so that his son could be born. And effectively you get Israel being born and delivered as a child and delivered out into the wilderness so that they could come to Mount Sinai and worship God their father. It's a beautiful imagery where God takes his people out of Egypt. He rescues them from slavery and he gathers them at Sinai. But in doing that, a son is born. That's the image that we get here. And a son is named and a son is brought to his father. And the language that God uses at Mount Sinai when he speaks to his people, it's language of brought you to myself and I'm going to call you my people and I'm going to be your God. And it's not because you're impressive, it's not because you're bigger than all the other nations, it's not because you're lovable in any way, it's just because me, in my love, I decide to choose you and take you as a child to me. It's all of God's initiative. He's the one who has love for the loveless. And this is what he does, is he takes a nation of slaves and calls them his own son. The imagery really it conjures up images like this of a father who literally has a son born into his arms. I'm not sure if any of you dads out there actually got to catch your kid, you know? Kind of messy business, I know. But like, it's also a beautiful image. The father who has a son delivered into his arms and then takes that son to his chest and says, mine. One of my mates this week, who's kind of my age, is in his 40s, has just had his first kid. So, you know, laid off the mark, but, you know, got the job done. And he had this kid and a son, and he posted a picture on Instagram because, you know, if you don't post a picture to social media really immediately, it hasn't really happened. So he posted this picture, and the picture is of him bare-chested, you know, with his son, you know, naked on the day he was born, washed off, you know, but just on his chest, just snuggled in like that. I'm not sure, you know, skin to skin bonding. I'm not sure if you guys are into that kind of stuff. I'm super into it. I did that with all my kids. And like, it's a beautiful picture of this father with this son on his chest. And whether you're into that image or not, this is the kind of what's conjured up as God speaks about how Israel were born to him. He gathered them to himself. He brought, put him on his chest and go, you're my people. I'm going to give you my name. I'm going to bless you. I'm going to call you my own. This is the affection of God for his people. This is the tenderness and the excitement of God for Israel as they're born to him. You could probably say, if this is the moment at Egypt where they're released of the birth and delivery, you could probably say the conception was back with Abraham, with the promise made there. And here's the birth and delivery. And it's so beautiful. And the imagery goes on. It's not just that Israel are given life and love and born to God. Then God actually stays and raises them as a young child. And you see all the imagery as it goes on here. Look at verse 3 with me. It was I who taught Ephraim to walk, taking them by the arms. But they did not realize it was I who healed them. I mean, isn't that cool imagery? God's like, this is the kind of God I am. This is how I've been towards my people, Israel. I'm like the father who taught them to walk. Now, if you ever had the great privilege of trying to teach a little kid to walk, it's super cute, isn't it? You got to get down on their level, you got to bend your knees, you got to take their arms in your hands, and you got to shuffle yourself backwards as they start taking their first few steps. It's so cute. You're down on their level, you're looking them in the eye, there's giggles going both ways, everyone's celebrating, it's a beautiful moment, there's affection and tenderness. God's like, this is what I did with my people. And then, you know, once you've taught the kid to take a few steps, then you kind of think, oh, I think they've got it, and you let go and they take a few on their own, and then you give them a big hug and they're celebrating, and then you go, let's do some more, and you take a few more steps back, and they go again and they go flat on their face, right? And then the loving father or parent, actually you scoop the kid up and you actually comfort them and you help them recover. And God's like, this is what I did with my people. You know, when I brought them to Sinai and I gave them the Ten Commandments and all of the law about how they were to live, I was teaching them to walk. And their first few steps were towards me. Their first few steps was to follow me and be my son and live according to my way. And I'm there teaching them. And when they fall, I scoop them up and I heal them and I help them and I comfort them. This is what our God has been like towards his people. Such beautiful imagery. And the imagery goes on. Look at verse 4. I led them with cords of human kindness, with ties of love. To them I was like one who lifts a little child to the cheek, and I bent down to feed them. This imagery of, you know, being led with cords of human kindness and ties of love. Some people think this is a reference to, you know, in the ancient world the dress was often this long thing with or an apron that had tassels or cords literally coming off it. And often young children in that day would just take a hold of the cords of their parents' cloak or whatever, and that would be a way of staying close and connected and safe and being led in the right direction. So kids would just hang onto these cords and totter around after their parents, and that was the safe place. We don't really have those kind of things these days. Some people put their kids on one of those leads. That's always funny, isn't it? It's like taking to the dog park or whatever. But others, sorry if you did that with your kid. Others, you know, the kids will just kind of, where's the safety place with mum and dad? You know, it's just you attach yourself to the legs, you know, or you go in underneath, you put your arms around, that's the safe place to be. Have you ever had a kid come and do that to you? That's not your kid. Sometimes it happens in the foyer, doesn't it, when the kids are running around and they think they've found dad, and but they've found legs that look like dad's, and then they look up and say, oh, who's this kid? You know, who's this dad, you know? I remember doing that to my mum, actually, at a shopping centre. It wasn't my mum. I went up and grabbed this lady's hand and went, mum, and went, ah, it's not my mum, right? But that's what you go to. You go to that place, and God's like, that's what I did with you. I let you hang around here. I led you. I kept you safe as a little child, as my people. That's the kind of father I was. And I lifted the little child up to the cheek. And so, you know, God's not the kind of father that just kind of stands towering over his people just saying, come on, get your act together, grow up already, you know, stop doing silly things. He's the father that bends down and scoops up his kid and snuggles him in and gives him a big kiss. And, you know, kids, you know, they're just snuggly, you know. And he's the God who's affectionate towards his people. The one who bends down and feeds his children. You know, the only way to feed a little kid is to bend down and do it or put them up in a seat. You remember feeding kids? You know, I remember doing it. My kids are a bit older now. I still feed them sometimes. But, you know, you're scooping your little spoon of whatever it is, apple stuff, and you're trying to get it in their mouth, and, you're playing little aeroplane games. Yeah, here comes it. Or the choo-choo train or whatever it is. You're just trying to get the food in the mouth. But to do it, you're up close, you're personal, you've got to be intimate, you've got to work with them. It's not always going real well, but you're there and you're this is God, like, this is what I did. You know, I led my people out to Sinai. I gave them the law. I taught them to walk and follow me. I fed them the whole time they're in the wilderness. I'm literally getting water to come out of rocks. You know, I'm putting manna on the ground and quail on the ground day after day to feed them like a father. And as they would fall and they would stumble and they'd sin, I'd scoop them up and I'd heal them and I'd help them recover. You know, day after day, God has been tender, you know, training his people like an infant to walk and follow him. God has loved his people and protected his people and provided for his people like the best father you can imagine. And once you catch a glimpse of that, the way God has been towards his people, and then we dig in and we kind of see how Israel, God's son, has responded to that kind of loving upbringing and actually responded tragically to turn away from God their father and stubbornly rebel and go off after other fathers, other gods. We can feel the tragedy, yeah? When you see how God's raised his people and you see them turn away, we actually get to feel the Father's pain. And that's the idea here. We're meant to feel God's pain. He actually wants us to. He wants us to get it. Look at verse 2 and 3 where you see what God's people did, the way they responded. Verse 2, but the more they were called, the more they went away from me. You know that moment where a child is running toward danger, away from you, and you're calling out to them, come back. But it seems like the more you call to them, the more determined they are to just keep running in a stupid direction that's going to cause carnage for them. It's scary. It's frightening. You're frustrated. You're panicking. God's like, I'm calling to my people. And they just keep going. And where are they going? Verse 3. Well, you read on in verse 2, sorry. They sacrificed to Baals. They burned incense to images. So they go off after other gods, which in father-son relationship, they go off after other fathers. Like they ignore me, the one that raised them, and they're going and they're giving their affection and their praise and their love to some other father that didn't raise them, who's not even a father at all. He's not even alive. He's just some dumb statue that can't speak, he can't give life. Doesn't, you know, they're going off and doing that. It's just tragic and it's offensive to God and it's destructive for them as they go off and worship false gods. Verse 3, halfway through, they did not even realize it was I who healed them. It's like they forgot that I was the one that even rescued them from Egypt. It's like they forgot how powerfully I had to work and send the plagues to, in love, bring them out and have them born to me. It's just like they just can't even acknowledge it. It's so tragic. It's absolutely tragic. And if you can catch a glimpse of it and you can start to feel some of what God has felt as he's taken Israel to himself. And I think one thing to note as we dig into this kind of stuff is that our God is a God who feels. You know that? Our God is a God who has emotions. He feels pain and anguish and heartbreak. Probably even at a deeper level, I'd say at a deeper level than any of you or I would ever feel that kind of heartbreak. He's not this heavenly policeman that just sits up there trying to get everyone to behave. He's a father who's up close and personal and therefore grieves the sin of his wayward children. Our God is impacted by the sin of humanity. Can you feel his pain? And if you can and you can understand even just a glimpse of that, then that might help you in lots of different ways. It can help you in this way, is that God can actually handle, because God has emotions, he can handle your emotions, you know. He can handle your pain and your anguish and your you know, frightened feelings and heartbreak. You can come to him with those. He understands what it's like to feel the darkness and to feel the pain. And he can actually have compassion on you. And he can comfort you. Our God is the God of all comfort. The pain for him has been real. The offense for him has been real. The break in relationship has been so real. And so the consequences need to be real too for Israel, God's son. If he's a loving father, there actually needs to be discipline. And so there is. God is actually going to judge his people. There's going to be a level of punishment that he pours out on his people. You can pick that up in there in verse 5. Have a look with me. Will they not return to Egypt? Will not Assyria rule over them? Because they refuse to repent? A sword will flash in their cities. It will devour their false prophets and put an end to their plans. So God's punishment for them is going to come because they're refusing to repent. They refuse to turn back when God calls out to them. And so the punishment, the discipline that God's actually going to pour out on his people is through a nation that's north of them, Assyria. God is actually going to use Assyria and bring them down to invade the northern kingdom of Israel. And the sword is going to slice through the city and there's going to be people slaughtered. There's going to be bloodshed. There's going to be carnage. Most people are going to be killed and a few are going to be carried off, kidnapped into exile so that they would then be assimilated into Assyria. God's actually going to bring that kind of level of punishment. They're going to be taken off to Assyria. There's going to be almost, almost absolute destruction upon his people. And it actually happens. In 722 BC, Assyria invades and that very thing happens. And God said, that's me doing that to punish you. Now, how do you feel about that? I ask you how you feel because it matters how you feel. How do you feel when you hear about God's judgment? Because that's serious judgment. You know, to bring down a nation and actually bloodshed across his people and to have them kidnapped, some of them kidnapped and carried off, it's terrible. Do you ever find yourself thinking, ooh, it sounds a bit heavy? You know, do they really deserve that? And if you do, just be honest about where you're at with that. And here's the thing, if you ever think that, if you ever think, it's a bit strong, a bit of an overreaction of God possibly, I don't really understand why you would, you know, almost wipe them out like that. I think it's only possible to think like that. Well, here's a reason why I do think, sometimes we think like that, is if you've got a, what I'd call a sanitized picture of their sin. Yeah? You might kind of read this and say, oh, okay, so they sacrifice to a few Baals, burn a bit of incense. What's the big problem with that? I burn some incense from time to time, smells kind of nice. What's the, you know, what's the big deal? Well, if that's the case, dig into the details, even just a little bit, and you'll see what the big deal is. It's heavy. When you just actually dig into the details of Israel's sin and what it actually meant for them to go off after these other gods, you'll see not only how incredibly offensive it is to God their Father, but also how horrendous and wicked it is towards each other and how destructive it is for them as a community. Now, if you actually looked at this in your group this week, and you looked at chapter 11, you probably went back to chapter 9 and 10 as well. And if you did that, you would have heard the mention of places like Baal Peor and Gibeah and a few of the other things that are referenced in chapter 9 and chapter 10, where God is saying, you remember what happened there? You guys are still continuing that kind of vein. This is what you're like as a people. And if you did actually go back and dig into Numbers and look at those original incidences, or Judges chapter 19, if you did that, you know what I'm talking about here. It's horrendous, isn't it? It's absolutely sickening what they got up to. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, I'll just give you a quick little glimpse so you can see what the sin of Israel actually meant on the ground. As Israel went off and actually praised false gods and were led into idol worship, to participate in worshipping the Baals, it meant participating in a level of sexual immorality that was disastrous. It was blatant. And they would indulge in that level of sexual immorality in a way that ended up being really destructive on their own families and their whole community. What ends up happening for Israel as a nation is this. The sexual immorality that they need to participate in to worship these false gods seemed to inflame in them so much unholy desire. It just kind of bubbled out of them. That so much that the whole culture of Israel became quite a frightening place to be in. You know, which is to start with, God actually gives them the commandments and all the legislation so that they live as a beautiful community of people with Yahweh as their God, a place of care and protection and love. I tell you what, if you ever wanted to live in any nation in the ancient world, you'd live among Yahweh's people. But as they went off and followed the other gods, I tell you what, they spiraled as a nation and became even worse than the pagan nations, with their sexual immorality leading to a really frightening, dangerous place to live. And if you go to Judges chapter 19, you know what I'm talking about. Among one particular tribe, the tribe of the Benjamites, there's an incident recorded there where a woman is gang raped in the city square and then later dies due to her injuries in the morning. But following that event, you discover that the men of the city who committed the crime don't see the problem. In fact, they actually stand by their behavior and defend their behavior. It's like, who does that? Well, a whole city, a whole tribe of people who have just completely lost it and spiraled, that they think that that's an okay way to behave. You see, this wasn't just a one-off incident either. This was like became endemic. It was characteristic of God's people. These incidences that are recorded is not just Israel having a bad day or a bad week or a bad month. No, this is generational now. It's widespread. It's ongoing, unrepentant sin. Israel's sin was disastrous and it was horrific. And when you dig in and you catch a glimpse of what was really happening for them, and I ask you, do they deserve judgment? I think we'll all find ourselves going, absolutely. Burn them and bury them in the backyard. You know, it's like, it's heavy. In our day, when anyone commits this kind of a horrendous crime, like what we're speaking about here, typically, they get life in prison, or in other countries, you get the death penalty. You know, we observe this, and we kind of go, oh, this is not the time to show mercy. This is the time for judgment. And in our day and age, very rarely would you ever get someone who commits a crime like this trying to stand by their behavior and say, no, it's completely appropriate. What's wrong with that? No one even does that. But that's what Israel are doing. We're so horrified when something like this happens in our culture that we typically try and figure out why. How is it that a person or persons can commit such heinous crimes? And so we usually try and study serial killers, you know, try and figure out what happened to them. And there's no shortage of documentaries on about people who've committed murder and rape and all that kind of stuff. You kind of dig back in to see what happened. And typically what the documentaries will do or the investigations will do will trickle back through their life to try and see what happened for them. And inevitably what you find, typically what you find is in their childhood, there was abuse and trauma at a level that just actually completely messed them up. And we kind of go, oh, okay, well, that's probably why. But you know what occasionally they discover? They go back through the life of a person who commits heinous crime. They get back to their childhood and they discover that this person had actually a beautiful childhood. They were raised by caring, loving parents who did everything they could to shower them with all the right things and brought them up beautifully, and then they just turned. And when we see that, we're even more baffled. It's almost extra tragic. And this is Israel. This is God's people, raised in love, but they go so terribly bad. God needs to discipline them as a loving father. He needs to judge them. In fact, some would say you need to just wipe them out. But here's where we see how God is both like a man and not like a man. Have a look at verse 9 with me. See deep into the heart of God, the Father who's child has turned against him and he must discipline him. But look at who God is. Halfway through verse 9. For I am God and not a man, the Holy One among you. I will not come against their cities. In other words, I will not completely destroy them because I'm God, not a man. Now, this phrase, I'm God, not a man, is likely a shorthand version for the longer version that you get back in Numbers chapter 23 that goes like this. God is not a man that he would lie. He's not a man that he would change his mind. That's what men do. That's what humans do. They lie and they change their mind, but God's got, I'm not like that. I'm going to stick to what I said I would do. If I've made a commitment in the past in line with my character, then I'm going to do that. I'm going to fulfill that. And here's the moment where God actually makes explicit, he himself remembers, well, I'm the one that promised long ago when I took Israel to myself, and I took them to my, I promised long ago that they would be mine forever. And I'm not going to go back on that. So I'm not going to destroy them. I can't. I need to punish them, but I'm not going to wipe them out. That promise long ago was made through Abraham, mentioned it earlier, like the conception, where God through Abraham says, I'm going to bring a people from you, and they're going to be my people. I'm going to give them my name. They're going to be as numerous as the stars in the sky. I'm going to bless them, silly, and they're going to be a blessing to all the other nations on the earth, and that's what I'm going to do. And God makes that promise, Genesis chapter 12, 15, 17, and because he's made that promise, he's not going to go back on it. Because he's God, not a man. I will not completely destroy them, he says. Though I'm a just judge, and I'll bring judgment, I'm also love and mercy. And out of my character of love and mercy, I've made a commitment. I've made a promise to my people, and I'm not going to go back on that. And so I will withhold the full extent of my fierce anger. I'm going to withhold. Because I'm God. And I will be gracious. And I will show mercy. I'm God, he says. I will not act out of character for myself. And my character is character of love and mercy and justice, but love and mercy. So I will treat you based on my holy character. I'm the Holy One among you. I will not treat you based on how you've treated me. I will not treat you based on how I feel because of how you've treated me. I will treat you based on my holy character. And I tell you what, sometimes when we're trying to understand and explain how humanity's sin means we're worthy of judgment and death, and sometimes we talk about how even as God's people, because of our sin, you know, God would be justified to just completely wipe us off the earth. And sometimes the statement gets made that God could have just completely and maybe should have just completely destroyed us as his people because of his sin. I reckon we need to pause at that moment and go, really? Could God completely destroy and wipe out and annihilate his people? No. He's powerful enough to, but would he? No. Because that would be to act out of character for him, and he will not do that. He's love and he's mercy, and he's made a commitment and a promise that we will belong to him forever, so he will not. He cannot, you could say, destroy his people because his love and his mercy. I'm so glad that our God is God and not a man, because that's where our security comes from. A God who will stick to his promise that he's made, and he will keep us as his own forever and love us forever. How wonderful is that? He's not just a just judge. He is a lover of his people. And you can rest in the security of his love. I'm not a man, he says. You guys have got limits to the amount of mercy you can show. You draw a line on your mercy. But he's like, I'm holy, not human. And so I'm going to express my mercy and my grace. And so after a few verses announcing judgment, which he will do for his people, you get to verse 8 and there's a tone change. There's a change for God where his compassion and mercy well up. Have a look at it there with me. Look at verse 8. How can I give up on you, Ephraim? How can I hand you over, Israel? How can I treat you like Admah? How can I make you like Zeboiim? Admah and Zeboiim were like little cities kind of in the region of Sodom and Gomorrah back in the time where God actually did rain down burning sulfur and actually completely destroy and annihilate those cities. And he says, how could I do that to you, my people? Oh, I can't. I can't annihilate you. My love for you is so much and so strong that I've made a commitment to you and I can't go back on that. Verse 9, I will not carry out my fierce anger, nor will I devastate Ephraim again, for I'm God, not a man, the Holy One among you. I will not come against their cities. So something happens for God as he's announcing judgment here. There's almost a conflict within God due to the complexity of his own character. He's just, and it's right for him to have a fierce anger and wrath towards his people, but at the very same time, his love and his mercy, and here's where something changes in his heart. But it's not anyone else changing him, it's just his own character welling up within him. Look at halfway through verse 8, or the final two lines of verse 8. My heart is changed within me. So his heart of fierce anger, of judgment that needs to be poured out on his people, literally it says it recoils within him. Though it's just, it recoils within him and it's overwhelmed by something else. All my compassion is aroused. What wells up in God out of his own very character, which overwhelms his wrath and his fierce anger, is compassion and mercy. And so he grows warm and tender and it overwhelms his just wrath. It all bubbles up out of him. And God's mercy knows no limits. His mercy has no boundaries. His compassion is able to completely cover over all. You know, when you're back in chapter 10, verse 12, he speaks about his love that is unfailing and his righteousness that just showers over us. But how does he actually do this? How does God hold back his judgment and pour out his mercy? Well, it's because he actually does pour out his judgment somewhere. He poured out his judgment somewhere else, on someone else, in Israel's place and in our place. Where does he pour out the judgment that we deserve? He pours it out on Jesus, who is, and this is the important thing to note, he is the true Son. Yeah? He's the perfect Son. Jesus is the substitute for Israel, the fulfillment of Israel, the substitute for us. And did you pick that up in verse 1 and how it's fulfilled in Matthew chapter 2? Have a look at verse 1 again, where we get, out of Egypt I called my son. That's the passage that's quoted in Matthew chapter 2. Remember we did Matthew back at the beginning of the year? And as you go through those first few chapters of Matthew, just time and time and time again the Old Testament is quoted, and particularly there's a big theme of everything that Israel were meant to be is fulfilled in Jesus. So what you get in the early few chapters of Matthew is really this big picture over and over again. Jesus is the true Israel. Jesus is the true Son. It all gets fulfilled in him. Jesus is the one who in his early days had to go to Egypt to escape Herod's carnage. But then God calls his true Son out of Egypt. And Jesus grows up and lives a perfectly faithful life as the true Son of God, the Israel of God. And he fulfills what Israel never could do. And then he goes and dies in their place and our place to be the Son that Israel could never be, the true Israel. So we see now that it's actually in Jesus that everything gets fulfilled. And it's in Jesus that God's mercy goes out and calls his children, his sons, back to him. Which is what we get in verse 10 and verse 11. It's a beautiful way to finish this passage. You get the roar of God's mercy going out. It's so wonderful. Look at verse 10. They, that's Israel, they will follow the Lord. He will roar like a lion. And when he roars, his children will come trembling from the west. They will come from Egypt, trembling like sparrows, from Assyria, fluttering like doves. I will settle them in their homes, declares the Lord. So here's how God's going to show mercy and compassion on his people Israel back in that day. Though they get scattered out around Assyria and other nations, God's going to do what's never happened before in history. He's going to pull a kidnapped, exiled people back. He's going to gather them back out of the nations and resettle them in the land, in their homes. He's going to show astounding mercy because of his commitment to keep his people as his own, that they would live on and fulfill the promises that he made towards them. But of course, that regathering of his people Israel back into the promised land back in the ancient times really wasn't the fulfillment of this promise that's given here. Really, this is all fulfilled in Jesus. Yeah? Jesus is the one through whom the roar of mercy goes out. I mean, I love the imagery here. You know, we get an image of God being the Father, the perfect Father, but now God's the lion. It's cool, isn't it? And there's a roar of the lion to actually call his people back to him, and the children are the ones who come trembling and fluttering home, humbly, repenting of their sin, coming back to their Father. And this imagery of lion is just perfect, isn't it? I mean, It's the ultimately God's mercy goes out through Jesus, and Jesus is, as we know, he's the lion of the tribe of Judah. He's the fulfillment of all of this. You go to the book of the Revelation, and we see that Jesus is like the lamb that's slain, who takes on himself the punishment we deserve, but then he rises again from the dead and roars like a victorious lion. The lion of the tribe of Judah. And I tell you what, it is through Jesus the roar of God's mercy goes out to the earth and calls the children of God to come. Come back. Come trembling and fluttering back. You can't help but to think about C.S. Lewis's Narnia kind of imagery when you hear, this is where he got it from, you know, like all this imagery about, you know, the lion that represents Jesus in that series, you know, Aslan. Roars over the nation, you know, the nation of Narnia. I'm going to get it wrong here, but all those who are sons of Adam, all those who are actually children of God, they hear the roar and it comforts them. You know, it helps them know, oh, the king's on the throne. We're going to be safe. He loves us. He's going to care for us. But those who are enemies of Aslan, the roar is not so, it's not so comforting. It's frightening. But here's the thing, our God roars to the earth through Jesus. And his roar is a roar of mercy to call his children to come back. And if you hear that roar, how wonderful is it that so many have heard the roar of God's mercy through Jesus. And we've come fluttering, trembling, humbly repenting of our sin back to our Father, back home to be settled with him. How wonderful is it to know that. And if you're here with us this morning and you're thinking, I don't know what to make of this roar, you know. You're telling me it's a roar of mercy, but I'm just not so sure about it. I tell you what, if you can see the love of God, if you can hear the mercy of God in the roar of what he's done with Jesus, and you can repent of your sin, you can come home. You can come to God and have him as your father. And I tell you what you do that, what you do is you step into the security and the love of his arms and the protection of having him as God. And you step into being able to actually follow him and live the way he designed for you to live with us. How wonderful is it to see the love of God and feel the love of God? Let me pray. Oh, Father, thank you for your word to us here. Thank you for going out of your way to help us catch a glimpse of who you are and what you're like and how you feel. And it's so comforting to know that you're a God of mercy. You're a God of unfailing love. You're a Father who raises us in love. And you're merciful to us, even in our sin, ultimately through Jesus. Lord, we want to honor you. We want to follow you. We want to live in your love. Please, by your Spirit, enable us to do that more and more so you get the praise and glory and worship that you deserve for being the loving God that you are. Amen.